Sí.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you for hanging in there on a really long day, but a wonderful day. I'm going to start off by saying that my sobriety date is September 6, 1994. My home group is the Red Door Church in Washington, and my sponsor's name is Melissa. And the reason why I start off every talk that I give giving those three things is not, they're not why I'm sober today, but they're the things that help to build a foundation for me to have a spiritual experience. So those are three things that I feel to be very important. I got to tell you, I had an awesome day. I heard some really wonderful speakers, people that I've heard before. I feel privileged to be here tonight. I think it's always a privilege when somebody asks you to speak, and I'm always happy to listen to other people share about their spiritual experiences and for me to be able to grow. But I'm here to talk about, you know, Chris told me to tell my story in steps, and, you know, and it, that happens to be like my favorite type of talk. You know, I do workshops, I do all kinds of other stuff like that, but I like talking about I like talking about what I do here and giving you a very good idea of what the past 15 years has been like. Because it's incredibly surreal to me that I am who I am today. In fact, it is categorically impossible for me to be anything other than what I was, which was a hopeless alcoholic who could not stay sober, who was miserable, unhappy, couldn't die, and tried a lot of times to do that. And to go from that to being the person I am today, I mean, there are times when I take a look at my life, I look in the mirror, and I look at, not even just look at the mirror or look at my life, but look at how the people who are in my life see me. And I'm absolutely amazed that if I could be half the person that they think I am, it's a freaking miracle. You know, so I'll tell you a little bit about me and to explain why that's such a miracle. I obviously got sober at 18, which means that, and when I hear people say all the time, they're like, wow, you're so lucky. I'm like, yeah, I am. I'm incredibly lucky to have from my entire adult life thus far, never drawn or never been drunk and always drawn a sober breath. I mean, that's amazing. That's a miracle. My kids have never seen me drunk. Again, that's a miracle. But on the other hand, you got to think about what is it would motivate an 18-year-old girl to stop drinking? The thing that she loved to do more than anything else on the face of the earth. And I'll tell you what it is. And for me, it was the benefits that I was getting from drinking did not outweigh the psychic pain that I was carrying. You know, I'm somebody, my husband likes to say, you know, in the wives, it talks about the different, you know, phases of types of alcoholic, and you know, you have type one, type two, type three, type four. He says that I drink like a type three, but my spirituality is a type six, that I'm ultra sick. You know, funny, but you know, and that's really true. I was somebody who felt very empty for as long as I can remember. I don't remember ever being really happy. I mean, I can remember times when I probably should have been happy in my life. But I wasn't. There was always a feeling of not being worthy or undeserving of whatever that was. You know, and so you take somebody who feels like that about themselves or looks at the world always from a place of less than or not good enough or unworthy of love or affection. And you give them something that kills that feeling, namely alcohol. And why would I want to not do that anymore? I mean, alcohol was able to, what it did for me is it turned down the voices, the pain, the suffering in my head. That being me and being here, present in the moment, and not having some buffer between my thoughts and you was so painful, I could not live. I could not function. So when I put alcohol in my body, And it did this amazing thing for me. It made all that go away. And so I did it again and again and again. And we've heard today in detail, you know, what craving is, what mental obsession is, and what the spiritual malady is. You know, and whenever I give talks, I always, even if you've heard it 1,000 times, there might be that one person who didn't understand it or didn't hear it. So I'm just going to quickly give it to you. Basically, when I drink, I can't control how much I drink. That I have physically unable to do so, and I can't decide when I'm done. And when I put it down and I try to control my drinking, I can't enjoy it. I have a mind that says, that's okay. Why not? I have a mind that says that secretly everybody else is doing exactly what I'm doing. They just lie about it. I have a mind that says, you know what? You grew up in an alcoholic household. Your dad beat the shit out of you. You were raped, molested. You had a horrible life. You deserve to drink. And screw them if they don't like it, because they deserve to be punished because they made you an alcoholic. My mind tells me things like that when I have an alcoholic mind. And I have this spiritual malady that says, be afraid, always be afraid. It says that no matter what I do, I'll never be good enough. It says that I'm always 5 pounds too heavy. My boobs will never be big enough. It says that I'm just not smart enough, and everybody knows it. And even if you pretend to be something that you want to be, eventually they're going to find out. You know, and that's the state of my being when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I darkened these doors, I was 13 years old. I didn't come here because I wanted to. I came here because my parents went to Al-Anon, and they decided I should come here. And I didn't do anything here. I drank some coffee. I met some boyfriends. I found rides to Newark. I did that for 5 years. I kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept being driven by my parents and dropped off at the door saying, you need to get this sign to prove you were here. You know, whatever outpatient rehab I was in, whatever contract I signed with them. And it was, you come here, they'll fix you. But I didn't want to be fixed because I didn't believe that I didn't believe it was capable, or that you were capable, or this program was capable, or God was capable of fixing me, because I felt so incredibly broken. And I felt completely unworthy of having a normal life. You ever feel like that? Like, you know that it works for everybody else, and everybody else says they're happy. And you look around the room, and you're like, but you don't know how I feel. And if you were me, and you had my experiences, it wouldn't work for you. That somehow you're special, you're different, and it works for you because maybe you're just not as flawed as I am. So I came to these rooms and I felt very, 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 very flawed. And, you know, people tolerated me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I've been thrown out of meetings. I've come drunk. I've stolen things, which I have made amends for. I have been disruptive. My home group had a group conscience on me because I didn't wear underwear. They were going to throw me out. I'm not kidding. But they decided to keep me. I guess I was entertaining enough. But that's what, you know, that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And obviously I didn't stay sober. But I'll tell you a little bit. Is when I was, ready to have an experience that was going to allow me to recover from alcoholism, you know, thank God, God presented me with somebody who can give me an answer that would actually work. Because the things that I was doing, or the what I heard in these rooms, it was killing me. You know, I heard make 90 meetings in 90 days. I did that. And you know what? Half the time I showed up drunk because I couldn't get from my house to the meeting without drinking. Because I didn't have the power to do that. And I didn't understand that I had to get a higher power and an experience with that higher power in order to do that. So I thought, why is it that I can't leave my house and get to this meeting without getting drunk? I must be a complete and utter failure. You know, I had a sponsor. She told me to get a higher power. I said, I don't believe in God. She gave me a rock. She said, that's your higher power. My mother threw it out. What happens? My mother threw out my higher power. What am I supposed to do now? You know, I thought if I got a boyfriend in AA, that would work, except we kept drinking together, you know, and I kept cheating on him and he kept cheating on me. And then the people we cheated on would drink together. And it was just a bad scene. That didn't work. You know, I did dances, you know. AA dances suck, by the way. When you're a club kid, you go to an AA dance and you're like, oh my God, you guys suck. So that didn't work, you know. So what am I supposed to do? Everything that I'm being told in these meetings is not working for me. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? That's absolutely right. That is confirming the fact that I'm an absolute failure. And that, you know, it's not just that I'm an alcoholic, that I'm completely unworthy of having a good life. And that's why I can't get sober. You know, and I don't know why on September 6th, 1994, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for whatever reason, God had graced me with a period of abstinence long enough for me to have an experience with the steps so that I could become recovered. I don't know why that happened, and I can't tell you what I can't, because I didn't know what being an alcoholic was, what I described to you as far as the threefold disease. I didn't know that. All I knew is that, and I remember the day I was in East Orange, and if you're from Jersey, you know where East Orange is, and you know what people are doing in East Orange when you're in East Orange. I was in East Orange, and my mother was driving home from work, and mind you, I'm 18 years old, and it's like maybe a couple weeks past my 18th birthday, and I had just run away. I ran away from home on Mother's Day, and I left with a, I think he was 35 or 37, let's say 35-year-old man who had a couple kids, a couple ex-wives, and I just my hefty bag and my backpack on the back of his motorcycle on Mother's Day. That's the kind of daughter I was. I did make amends for that, too. but the idea is I ran away from home. I was living with this guy. And then I decided that this guy wasn't cool enough, so then I went for this other guy. And we decided to live in East Orange, and we're down in East Orange, and we're doing what we're doing. And my mother, who hadn't seen me in weeks, who didn't know whether I was dead or alive, and I'd run away with this guy who could, at that point, he could have been my father, for that matter. Ew. now that I think about it. She sees me standing on the street corner, and our eyes connect in her, like she's driving, you know, and she sees me, her eyes connect. She looks away and keeps driving. Because, and I knew, she could not stop her car because she knew if she pulled over that I would break her heart again. That she could, just having a conversation with me would be more painful than not knowing where I was. And you know what, even that experience I didn't get sober for months after that. Because that wasn't enough to help me to stop drinking. What helped me to stop drinking, or what happened when I put, when alcohol was done with me, was I woke up in a basement and I was homeless again. And I had no one, nothing, no money. I'd just been robbed by the biggest junkie in town. At that point, there was not one person who was willing to speak to me. But I knew that AA still tolerated me. I knew that they would be okay with me and let me come back and someone would at least talk to me. And so I just said to God, I said, God, if you can get me to this meeting and if I could not drink, I'll do whatever I have to do. And I walked to that meeting and I promptly stole the big book from that meeting. It was a big book meeting. I stole it. I made amends for that too. And, you know, and I found the first person who seemed to know what they were doing. I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, call me at 6 o'clock. So I did. And she said, call me at 6 o'clock the next day, and I did. And I was able to do that for a little while, and because I was scared enough, and because I was burnt enough, and I was willing enough to do anything, I was able to stay sober for almost 2 years, but I was miserable, because I still had all that pain. I mean, I could remember, I was living in Staten Island, and I had about 18 months clean. And I remember being in a meeting, and I had this cup of coffee, and for me, they used to call me Shaky Carrie, because I would walk to the table with a cup of coffee in my hand, and I was so full of fear and so full of anxiety, my hands would shake and half the cup of coffee would be on the floor and all over me, and I would just sit there and I'm like, I hope I don't have to pee and get up. And I remember being, I was 18 months sober, and I'm sitting in this meeting, and I get my cup of coffee, and I realize, I look around, and I'm absolutely terrified. And I'm looking at everybody, and I'm like, they know how absolutely empty I am, and how broken I am, and they see through me. And what am I going to do? How can I live like this? I can't do this anymore. I can't even live sober. I had a 1-year-old. I knew I had an experience with alcohol that taught me that I couldn't drink. I had an experience with suicide, i.e. dying for 2 minutes, waking up in the ICU days later, and realizing that not even God wanted me. That kind of sucked too. So I had that experience. So I couldn't kill myself. I couldn't drink, and I couldn't live as I was. And I didn't know what to do. And a couple weeks later, my sponsor decided that we were going to try a new meeting. So I walk in this meeting, and there's this guy sitting there, and he looks like a... If Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had sex, this is what this guy would look like. And he's sitting there, and he's talking about the 9-step in amends. And he's talking about having had a spiritual awakening. He's talking about being free. And it was right before he was leaving to go to India. And he's talking about all this stuff. And I'm like, you know, screw you, man. You don't know shit. You know, who the hell are you? And what are you talking about? And like, what are you doing here? And I'm like giving this attitude, this Jersey girl, snotty brat, punk chick attitude, you know, and he just pulled me aside very lovingly and said, you know, do you know what the big book is? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you know, have you ever done any step work out of the big book? I'm like, I read it and it sucked, you know, you know. And he's like, well, you might want to consider, you know, getting a sponsor and maybe doing some of the stuff in that book. And I'm like, that stuff's old and we don't need to do that. And we've evolved past that. And, you know, I read self-help books and I do all this stuff. And I've been in therapy for a really long time. And my inner child is really angry. And this stuff isn't going to fix it. And he asked me some questions. He asked me about craving. He asked me about mental obsession. And he asked me about the spiritual malady. All of the things that we talked about today. All the hot button considerations. And what he did was he qualified me as an alcoholic. I didn't know that's what he was doing. I just thought he was weird. And he asked me all these questions. And then he pulled in somebody else's over. Well, you know, now he's got me in the corner and he's got me answering these questions. He's got me thinking about it. And then he starts pulling people in. And he goes, you know, get this kid. And I've done this, so I know exactly what he's doing. Now he's like, get this kid. Do not let her leave this meeting without a sponsor. You know, and I didn't. And I started to go through the steps in the big book. And I began to have a spiritual experience. And I began to wake up. And I began to get free. And I began to realize that incredible weight of terror, anxiety, unworthiness, all of those things, they began to lift. And it was not instantaneous. It wasn't like I woke up one day and says, I'm great and brand new, honey. Because I was a very broken young little girl when I got here. And it took some time for this stuff to really penetrate all of the walls that I had up. You know, because I had a war with God. I hated God. I wasn't going to go to a higher power for, you know, recovery from my alcoholism. I only did it when I was absolutely desperate. But that whole daily thing, no way. You know, to me, God was somebody who, I felt God was responsible for the horrible things that had happened to my life. And what happened was I had a sponsor that explained to me that what free will was. I mean, I had never considered that it wasn't God who was playing chess with me, making bad things happen because he thought it was funny. Because that's exactly how I perceived it when I got here. You know, but when a sponsor sat down and explained to me that what free will is and what that means, and the best way that I explain it, and, you know, I'm going to use my friend Anthony as an example. I always use him when he's talking. I said, you know, there's nothing stopping me from walking across the room and punching Anthony in the face. Nothing. Who's going to stop me? You guys going to throw yourself in the way? Maybe. But there's nothing really going to stop me from doing that. I can punch him in the face if I feel like it. And whatever consequences I'm going to get, right? But there is something that's telling me that it's a really not a very nice thing to do. That's a really bad idea because I like Anthony. He's my husband's sponsee and a very good friend. So why would I want to punch a very good friend in the face? That's not a very loving thing to do, Carrie. See that? So I have free will. I can go punch him in the face if I want to. But then I have this inner experience that I have with God that tells me, gee, honey, that's not a really good thing to do. And you might want to take a look at that. And that for me is that conscious contact with a higher power. So what I didn't understand was all the times that I did things that I didn't want to do, all the times that I hurt people, I thought it was because I was a bad person. And what I realized was what it was is I wasn't aligning my will with God's. And that I was so blocked, and a big book talks about it, says we're blocked by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. You know, I was so blocked by those things that I couldn't hear that voice. And that voice had to scream in order for me to hear it. Today, I hear that voice all the time. It's a part of me. I rely on it. I mean, I rely on it in the same way that I rely on my lungs to pump, you know, to breathe for me, and my heart to pump my blood. Because I could not function in my daily life if I didn't have a connection to that. Because there's no way I could show up for my life in the way that I do if I didn't have a conscious contact with my higher power, if I didn't have a relationship with my higher power. So when all this stuff was explained to me and I had an experience with these steps, a lot of this stuff just started to fall away. You know, and what I really like to talk about, I mean, and that's my, you know, what I really like to talk about is not just how I was first introduced to the steps, but how over the past 15 years, how that's changed for me. What was very simple and was just a matter of writing down some, you know, resentments and doing my four step, taking a fifth step and actually just telling somebody the truth for the first time in my life. You know, and not holding anything back. And I remember being terrified that this woman was going to hate me, and she didn't. I walked away feeling so relieved and full of love, you know, and going out and making those amends. I mean, they were not easy amends to make, but they were absolutely beautiful. I mean, I was such an angry person that I just bulldozed over everyone around me. You know, and to be able to go back and make the amends to my family and the people who love me. You know, I was thrown out of 5 high schools in the state of New Jersey. And eventually I just dropped out. I went back to every one of those schools and made amends. You know, I've paid back my parents for the rehabs, the lawyers, the schools. My parents are working class parents. I mean, they don't make an incredible amount of money, but they're very generous with their children. And if we have potential, they're willing to show up for us and work hard and make sure that we can get an education or the opportunities that they believe we deserve. So they put me in private schools in which, had I completed them, I probably would have went to a better college. But anyway, you know, they put me in these schools, and, you know, and I didn't see that. Then I saw them put me in Catholic school to make me be good, you know. And they put me in, one of them was an all-girls Catholic school. I felt that was the supreme punishment, you know, until I used my bus money that I was supposed to be using to go back and forth to school to do what I needed to do and hitchhike down Bloomfield Avenue. I felt that was a good, in my Catholic school uniform, I felt like that was paying them back a little. You know, to sit down with my parents and the change in my perspective and my perception and to be willing. And I'll tell you what, it took me a long time to truly set right the harms that I caused. It did. I don't think my family trusted me for a good 3-4 years after that. You know, they really didn't, because I was really crazy. To pay back the money, to do those things. I mean, I can remember the most freeing amends I can remember. It's the silliest one. It was walking into the CVS that I shopped in every day. But when I was a kid, I used to shoplift from them. And to walk in and say, you know, I'm a member, you know, of a program of recovery, and I'm not going to get over my drinking unless I'm willing to pay this back. What can I do to set this right? And these people saw me all the time. I lived down the street. You know, and I went in and I was terrified to do it, and I did it, and I walked out and I realized I could make any amend at any time, anywhere. And it sounds silly. I mean, I wasn't going to go to jail. It wasn't anything. It was a matter of swallowing my pride and going in there and being willing to do it. You know, I realized that there was not anybody that I couldn't see that I wouldn't be willing to step up and take care of it. You know, and that was incredible to me. And that wasn't because of me. It wasn't anything that I could do, because anything that I would do would be full of fear and dishonesty and selfishness. That it came from this power. But this power wasn't outside of me. It was a power that was actually coming from within me, that was giving me the courage, the strength, and the ability to do things that I never believed myself capable of doing. It was absolutely amazing, because I knew that it wasn't me, yet it was. You know, and so I had these incredible experiences, and I've been privileged to do a hell of a lot of 12-step work. I'm a lucky woman. I mean, I've been lucky because I've had the right teachers in my life. I've had the right spiritual teachers. I've been able to work with some of the most wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of that, it puts me in a position to meet a lot of people. And I've gotten the opportunity to do the wet drunk calls, and I do them pretty regularly. Not as early, not as much as the early AAs, but I think probably more than the average Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my husband and I detox people on our couch when necessary. You know, these are the things that we do. Mostly because a lot of the drunks we have, they won't be, St. Clair's just won't take them back. They've already been there 37,000 times. They have no insurance and nowhere to go. So we babysit them. We let them rock and roll, let them do what they have to do. We clean up the mess when they're done. And as soon as they're done shaking just a little bit, give them a couple days, they're through the steps. That's our experience. That's what we do. You know, my husband and I, you know, we have four children. You know, my husband got sober on the same day I did. We've been married for 15 years. We work together. You know, our program of, this is something we bring into our family. My daughter has done 12-step calls. We had this humongous house meeting at our house, and we had this little 3-bedroom apartment for the longest time, but it was infamous in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we would have 30, 40 people in our living room reading the big book, and everybody would leave, and they would go, and they would go to their home group, they would grab newcomers and come back. And then they would start meetings, and they would, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. And all these people, I meet people, I swear, I'll be at a meeting, they'll be like, dude, I was at your house. I'm like, you were? Oh, cool, man. You know, and they're like, yeah, you know, I remember seeing you this. And I'm like, all right. I mean, like, this is how awesome it is. You know, so we, you know, we have this meeting, and we were inspired by other people who were doing that very same thing. You know, so we've had this house meeting. It has been going on since we were 2 years sober. You know, we just moved, so we took a hiatus, but it's starting up again in another month because we moved from New Jersey to Pennsylvania. We got a bigger house where we could fit more people. Score. So the idea is, you know, and now we have decks and stuff too. So maybe we can move it outside, inside. It's going to be fun. We're thinking about what we can do. But the idea here is that, you know, we've had this ongoing meeting for about 12 years. And through that, we've been able to touch a lot of people. And my children know what an alcoholic is. They know that mommy's an alcoholic. They know that daddy's an alcoholic. But they know what being a recovered alcoholic is. So when one of my daughter's friend's mother said, you know, I hear your mom and dad have some kind of meeting at their house. I think it has to do with AA. My daughter goes, absolutely. My mom and dad have sponsees, and they have sponsees, and they have sponsees, and they all sit around reading the big book. She goes, well, is it by invitation only? And my daughter goes, no, anybody shows up. She said, well, can I come? She goes, sure. And the next Wednesday night, she was at my house. My daughter knew enough to be able to tell this woman what it is that we do. And it's because we do it every day. It's in my daily life. It's not something I just talk about. It's something I absolutely believe in with every fiber of my being. I do not believe that I could be standing here today if I didn't actually do what I say and say what I do. I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I'm not, you know, I can be totally, totally crazy. And I'm perfectly okay with that. I do not want to be an AA robot. I love the fact that I'm a complete fruit loop. And I think God loves that too. And I'm okay. We're chill with that. But the idea here is that I live this life where I get to do some incredible things and help some incredible people. I get to be a part of something that's so much bigger than what I am or what I could do in my own little tiny square. And that to me is so amazing, and it's such a gift, and it's so beautiful. Because I can remember sitting across my kitchen table, listening to somebody's fifth step and watching them heal and seeing God come into them. Seeing them light up from the inside and seeing pain fall away from them. And realizing that I was getting the most supreme privilege to witness it. And I witness that stuff every day. So on the day that I'm having a bad day and I'm not getting what I want, and I feel like being self-centered and self-seeking, and I do all the stuff I'm supposed to do, but I'm still not with the program, you know what I mean? And I'm just saying, well, it's still not fair. I mean, I do my 10-step. I admit that I'm somewhat at fault, but I'm sure other people are more to blame. That sort of stuff. And I stand there and I say, you know what? How dare I? How dare I? I mean, I get to have a life, or I get to see things. I get to be involved in things that are incredible. And how dare I not be grateful for what I have? How dare, and I get to see God every day. Not only do I get to experience God within me, but I get to see you experience God. So on the days when I want to doubt or that I don't want to play ball, I'm constantly reminded by the people that I have in my life how absolutely silly that is. Because whatever idea I have for myself is so incredibly limited compared to what God has planned for me. I was a high school dropout. I had a 10th grade education. And trust me, the 2 years I spent in high school, I really wasn't there. I mean, the fact is, I had an 8th grade education when I dropped out of high school in the 11th grade. I was a mess. I didn't think I could do anything. You know, and my sponsor was like, you know, you really need to get that GED. I'm like, I'm going to fail that test. I can't take the GED. She's like, well, you know, what about God and sobriety and that whole thing? I'm like, oh, yeah. So I took it and I passed it. Oh, my God. I went to college and I found out that I wasn't, you know what? When you're not thinking about yourself every moment of the day, when you're not crippled by fear, self-centeredness, and you don't lie all the time, there's a lot of room in your head to learn stuff. It's amazing. You actually remember stuff, too, because when I'm forgetting stuff, it means because I'm thinking about me. When I'm not conscious and I realize I'm forgetting my car keys, I'm forgetting my cell phone, I'm dropping stuff, that's because I'm not present. Because when I'm present, I'm not doing things like that. So that's one of my little guidelines. When I start losing my car keys, it means where are my feet? But anyway, I started to do this and I started to go to school and I started to find out that I was actually smart. And that I was capable of doing things that I didn't think I was capable of doing. So here I am. I have an 8th grade education. I graduate college summa cum laude. You know, and that's not because of me. That's not because of what I'm capable of. That's because I've had the benefit of the grace of God in my life. And that contact and that relationship and that connection between me and God has allowed me to do things and allowed me to use the potential that I always had, but I never knew how to use. You know, my kids are wonderful children. They're respectful and kind and considerate and generous. They also fight all the time and they're kids, but they're great kids. I was a juvenile delinquent. And my husband, when I met him, he was 5 months off of parole. You know, we're not the type of people to have great kids. We're the type of people where DIFAS comes and says, I want those kids. You can't have them anymore. Yet we have a wonderful family. And I'll tell you what, you know, most of the people that I sponsor don't, it's not really what I have that they want. You know, like me as an individual, but I realize one of the things that I see is the life that I live and the family that I have is so supremely attractive to people. The love that we have in our life. The compassion. You know, because ultimately, you know, what I have monetarily, which is very little, I have a lot of kids, very little. those sorts of things, I mean, they're that in the grand scheme of things, they mean absolutely nothing. But to have love and compassion, wholeness, happiness, and freedom, and to share that with other people, I mean, that to me is one of the greatest things that any person can actually do. And so I think that when people come to me and say, hey, Carrie, you know, here's my broken life, fix it. And I'm like, well, you know, I just want to remind you, I'm not God. But I'll show you how to get to him so you can take care of that stuff. But for me, what I think that attracts them isn't, you know, all of the stuff that I have or don't have, but who I've become. And the most amazing thing for me and the most beautiful thing is not that I want what other people have, but I like what I have and I want to be who I am. I definitely want to be a better version of me, but I want what I have. And to be able to say that with conviction and to know it to be true within me, to say, yes, there are things that I would like to do with my life. There are places that I'd like to go, goals that I may have that I've set for myself as an individual, saying that if it's God's will, I'll be there. But ultimately, who I am as a person and my character, I'm incredibly comfortable with that. And for me, I think that's the greatest benefit that I've gotten from AA, from the recovery program. Now, I've done a hell of a lot of service in the service structure. I mean, I've been at DCM, I've been at GSR, I've served on committees. I've done all of those things, and I've gotten a lot from that. You know, but my life, and I love it, and again, you know, it was today, the program of recovery was so supremely covered that I feel it's almost repetitive. But I mean, the idea is I do try to keep that triangle in balance. And I do try to make sure that I'm not paying attention to one aspect of that triangle more than another. You know, because as an alcoholic, I get carried away with stuff. You know, so I'll speak everywhere, but I won't be at my home group. Uh-uh. You know, or, you know, I'll be busy in service, but, you know, a newcomer walks up to me and I'm busy. I have to go home and work. I have to go home. I have to go to sleep. I have to work. No, I can give them 15 minutes of my time. I can give them an hour of my time. It's not my time anyway. God gave me a job to do, and it's my job to do it because it's presented in front of me. And sleep, that's a freaking luxury. I'm sorry. TV, I don't watch it. I read a lot of books, though. I'll give you that. But, you know, these are things that I'm willing to sacrifice because of what I get from it. I mean, I don't remember the last time I've actually been to a movie. I think, wait a minute, no, I saw the last Harry Potter. The time before that was a year before. And it's not because I don't have a life, it's because I have a life. You know, and it sounds silly, but, you know, these are things that I'm willing to sacrifice because I get to do all kinds of cool shit. Excuse my language. You know, and so, yeah, well, I don't know what's, you know, what the newest movie's out. And I have to TiVo everything and watch it in 15-minute increments every day. It takes me a week to watch an episode of House. But I watch it. But the idea here is that I would much rather sit with an alcoholic and give them my time than watch a stupid TV show. I would much rather be with my children and be present with them instead of yelling and stomping around the house and everything's a mess and stuff like that, you know, which I can do. Which I make amends for. But anyway, the idea is I'd much rather be present with my children in my family and bring to them the mom that they deserve, the wife that they deserve. And how I do that is through all 36 principles. I can't do it. You know, I can't do it without using all of them. You know, and that means a lot of sacrifice, and it means a lot of time, and it's time I'm willing to give. You know, and I'm grateful for it because it's a privilege. So that's what my life looks like. You know, I was a homeless street rat who got thrown out of meetings, who didn't wear underwear, that their home group had to take a group conscience whether it was okay to keep her there, who couldn't get to a meeting without getting drunk, whose own mother disowned her while she was standing in the ghetto doing what she was doing, you know, and my life today, you know, my brother had a problem a couple of years ago, and And he ended up in Sunrise House and St. Clair's. Actually, he was at St. Clair's when the same time my husband's sponsee and my sponsee were there. So we actually brought my brother to St. Clair's like 2 days after we had just brought the last person. They were like, dude, what are you bringing in busloads? We're like, sorry, man. We got another one for you. Ha, ha, ha. But when my brother had a problem, my parents called me and my husband and they said, you know what? Everybody, and we stayed quiet. My brother had a problem for a really long time, but it wasn't my place to say anything. When he wanted to talk about it, I brought it up. But other than that, I shut my mouth and I minded my own business. And the reason why is because had I talked to him when he wasn't ready, it would have made it so that he wouldn't listen to me when he was. So when he would bring it up and he'd be like, yeah, you know, I know I'm smoking crack. And I'd be like, yeah, I know, Jimmy. I know you know that's not good. But I'm not going to yell at you about it because why bother? You're just going to do it again tomorrow. And he's like, yeah. And I said, okay, just let me know when you're done. And that would be it. Everybody would be sitting down at the table going, why are you doing that? And I'd say, you want a cup of coffee? So when my brother hit bottom, he called us. He actually was at it wandering without any shoes, inebriated at a train station in Bootin. And I don't know. I didn't even ask how the hell he got there because he had no license. And I don't even want to know. He lived 30 miles away. It's none of my business. So he's wandering around Bootin with no shoes, a complete and total mess. And he calls my house and for us to come get him. So my husband picks him up, and all my husband's sponsees are there. They're at the dining room table doing a step workshop. So I take over for him while he goes to get my brother, because my brother's like 6'4", and there was no way I was going to carry his ass to the car. So he goes with one of these guys. He goes to get my brother. I sit there and take over for what he's doing with his guys with work. He comes back. My brother's a mess. I'm carrying him into the house, and we're like, who wants to go on a detox run? Who wants to know what we got to do? So then my husband, you know, we do what we do. We talk to my brother. Do you want to do this? What are you willing to do? Let's get you in the car and we take him. Well, you know, a couple years later, again, it's none of my business what he's doing, but I'm available when he's ready to go do that again. But the idea here is this, is that I went from being somebody that my mother would ignore on the street because she was horrified by the person I had become, to being when my family was in crisis and when somebody was in trouble, that they relied on me to do the best that I could to show up for them. I can't tell you how beautiful that feels. And I'm sure that if you guys have had a spiritual awakening and you're living on a spiritual basis, you know exactly what it is that I'm talking about. And my older sister, I moved to Pennsylvania and I live a couple towns away from her now. And she sent me an email. I went to her birthday party and I was exhausted and sick and I had been working like a madman, and I came in and I took the day off of work and I went to her party and I didn't want to. I wanted to play hooky so bad. I wanted to play hooky from work and I wanted to play hooky from her birthday, and all I wanted to do was stay home and take a nap. And I didn't do it. And I showed up for her party and I was a good sister and she was grateful that I was there, and she knew that I really, 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 really wanted to be in bed, but I was fun. And I had a good time, and I wasn't a mope about it. So the next day, she sent me this email, and she was like, you know, your incredible generosity and unselfishness amazes me. This is my older sister who I robbed. And, oh, did I tell you that I tried to kill myself in her house twice? This is the older sister that I tried to kill myself in her house twice, who today thinks that I'm a generous, unselfish person. If she only knew. But the point is that what amazes me is what the people in my life see me do and know who I am. And that is not through anything other than being willing to show up and practice this program. And the only reason why I do that is because I don't want to die. I mean, it's not a virtue that I work the 12 steps. It makes sense. I have two options. I have a disease that I'm either going to die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. That's the only two options I have. You know, so I don't do this because I'm such a wonderful person. I do this because I'm an alcoholic and I didn't want to die. And what I found out after doing all of this stuff is underneath it all, I really am a wonderful person. My motivation for learning how to do this stuff was to save my own ass. But ultimately, the experience I had was so transcendent that it didn't matter that it was self-preservation that motivated me to do it. Because today I would do it anyway. If you told me that, you know what, Carrie, you put 15 years in, you could retire, I wouldn't want to. Because I absolutely love what it is that I do. You know, and so, I mean, I don't think there's anything more that I could say about my life other than if you don't feel that way, if you don't feel like your life is what it should be. Because if you have this experience, you realize that you are exactly where you're supposed to be and you feel incredibly safe and know within you, despite any fear that you may have, that you are absolutely okay. So if you're not fulfilled in your life and who you are, my suggestion to you would be to go through the steps. And if you did it and you still feel that way, that's because there's probably something you missed. I mean, one of the things, and this is just for the women, I'm sorry, guys. I mean, it's been a guy day, so I'm going to do the girl thing for, I got 4 minutes, and we're going to do the girl thing for 4 minutes. Look, there are not a lot of women who have long-term sobriety and extensive experience with the 12 steps. A lot of times women want to make you feel better and tell you to take a fucking bubble bath, give you a cookie, and pat you on the head. That is not what we need. I need a boot in the ass and to be told that I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic and what I think doesn't matter. Do what I fucking tell you to do. And women are unwilling to do that. You know why? Because we're afraid. Because we're afraid. We're afraid that we're going to be judged or people are going to call us a bitch. No. My job is not to be liked in Alcoholics Anonymous. My job is to help the newcomer, to help that person who wants to recover. And it doesn't matter if people think that I'm a bitch. It doesn't matter if people think I'm mean. They're going to think that anyway. But there might be that one person who is desperate and dying that I can help because I am frank with them about the nature of our condition. Because I'm frank about what the solution is and what that means. That is a life or death errand. And a lot of times, we women, we soft sell it. We soft sell it because we don't want to be perceived as being bitchy or mean. We soft sell it because of fear. And you know what? I'll tell you what. There are women where I live who say that I am the meanest woman they have ever met. There are women where I live who say, she's the meanest woman I ever met, and thank God I met her. And there are women who say, you know what? She changed my life. Thank God. Thank God she cared enough about me not to care about how I felt. Not to care about my feelings. She cared enough about my life. And one of the things, and I don't know if it's a woman thing, something society tells us that we need to do, that we need to be dainty and sweet all the time. But you know what? This is not a dainty or sweet disease. And this is a disease that demands utter frankness and honesty. And see, here's the thing, is I can call you on the carpet and I could tell you how I see it, but unless I'm willing to go there with you, that's not fair. So if I sit down with somebody and I say, and by the way, this is what I see and this is what we're going to do, I have to be willing to go with them toe to toe, step by step, shoulder to shoulder. And I am absolutely willing to do that. And one of the other things that we do is we're freaking lazy. We're busy. We have things to do. I have to go to the gym. You know what? Take a walk, hear a fist step. You know, I love combining 12-step work with crap I have to do. Oh, you want to do a fist step? Well, first you're going to hike up this mountain. Then we're going to sit there and we're going to do your fist step. And then we're going to hike down. This way I get to work out and I get to hear your fist step. We're good. You know, the fact is that we don't want to give up our creature comforts. We don't want to give up those things. We want to go to the gym. We want to get our nails done. You know when the last time I had a pedicure was? I haven't. I'm busy. I'm serious. It's not about money. It's because I'm freaking busy. That time could be spent doing other things. And you know what it's spent doing? 12-step work. Inside and outside Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so the idea here is that the women are dying in Alcoholics Anonymous because they're getting a watered-down message because nobody's willing to put their money where their mouth is and do what they say and say what they do. So what's happening is one of two things. Either men are sponsoring us, and sometimes that goes awry, or we're getting soft-sold messages, which means that The next person soft selling it. The next person soft selling. The next person soft selling it. All of a sudden, it takes somebody a year to write a four step. Bullshit. Doesn't take a year to write a four step. And that's what's happening. And so women are dying. And they're dying in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. Because nobody wants to take the 15 minutes after the meeting to talk to them. The guys will do it, but the girls won't. Why? Because we want to go home, and we have to. I don't know what it is what we have to do, but we don't take that time. Most of us don't. So the idea here is that, and what I'm saying is that we need to be as tough, and as radical, and as strong in our conviction as we should be. Because this is a disease that kills people every day. And I need to take my responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous incredibly seriously. So yeah, I cursed. Sorry about that. And that was mean, and I'm really sorry about that. But I'm not sorry about what I said, because I'll tell you what, I'm really tired of being the point man for the women who don't want to have this experience or don't want to carry this message and don't want to do these things. And I think that we all need to step up to the plate, and we need to be willing to do this. Because my kids have a better mom because I do this stuff. My job, my employer has a better employee because I do this stuff. I am a better person because I do this stuff. Everybody in my life benefits because I do this stuff. It doesn't take away from them. It brings a more whole carry to them. So the 20 minutes or the hour that I spend doing step work with somebody else, I can be more present in the 2 hours I spend with my family because of that 1 hour I spent with them. So they don't sacrifice or lose anything. In fact, they benefit incredibly from it. And so I want to thank you for inviting me here. And I want to thank you for being here and allowing me to participate in your workshop and your day. Thank you very much.